What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina. Now, Michael, you neglected to mention that this week was Michael Pina week on Twitter. I'm pretty sure you wrote a piece on every major website. I really appreciated your cover story on Vanity Fair about your amazing new look and overhaul of your summer wardrobe. Congratulations on that coverage as well. But in all seriousness, people need to check out your work on The Ringer, 538, GQ. Did I forget anything else, Michael?
No, but thanks for shouting out that profile I wrote about Regina King for Vanity Fair. Thank you very much for bringing that to the people's attention too.
Slight hyperbole, okay, but only a touch because you were everywhere. We're going to dive into some of the stuff that you've been working on later on this episode, but we have to start with chapter two of the You Bum Chronicles. 3 years after President Trump and LeBron James first tangled over the Golden State Warriors White House visit, we saw another exchange take place last night here in the bubble. Now, just to catch everyone up, obviously the players have been kneeling, as we've been talking about, and those demonstrations have garnered quite a bit of press attention. Donald Trump was asked about the NBA players kneeling. You know, he's been a critic of professional athletes in the past in general, but also specifically those who kneel during the anthem. On a Fox News interview, Trump said, quote, "I think it's disgraceful. We worked with the NBA very hard trying to get them open. Now I'm seeing everyone kneeling during the anthem. It's not acceptable to me. When I see them kneeling, I just turn off the game. I have no interest in the game." And basically, those comments were put to LeBron James after the Lakers took a pretty big loss to the Oklahoma City Thunder on Wednesday night. LeBron replied, "I really don't think the basketball community is sad about losing his viewership. The game will go on without his eyes on it. I can sit here and speak for all of us that love the game of basketball. We could not care less." He then went on to encourage everybody basically to vote in November, saying that it was a big moment for us as Americans. And then, Trump made a comment that he's made a number of times saying that, quote, "No one has done better for the black community than me, with the possible exception of Abraham Lincoln." LeBron was informed of that comment, and his reply was, "Are you trying to make me laugh right now? I appreciate that." So I think we pretty much got the full back and forth there, between these two parties. I'm curious, Michael, does this matter? Is this hot air? Is this just another, cycle of Twitter trash talk that ultimately leaves everybody feeling, a little bit empty and guilty after indulging? Or is this some reflection of progress in this conversation, as it relates to the NBA's Black Lives Matter demonstrations?
To pose this question as does it matter is really interesting to me, because it's sad that it does. It's the president of the United States who is a total buffoon, and he is basically flailing as a participant in the culture wars when there is a global pandemic going on. And whether or not NBA players are kneeling during the national anthem should be absolutely at the bottom of his to-do list in terms of griping about. It matters from that perspective, and it's just like down and out tragic that we have to talk about it like that. But it's always like good to see just LeBron eloquently combat him and kind of bat him down as trying to reduce him to as irrelevant a human being as he possibly can, which is very difficult because he's ostensibly the most powerful person on the planet. And also, every single time that Trump does say that no one has done more for the black community than him, it is truly like legit grade A comedy. So I echo LeBron's reaction to that as well.
I think it matters a lot, Michael. Here's my take. Here's why. The thing that rubbed me the wrong way about the You Bum controversy, and that was 3 years ago, 2017, mm-hmm. is that it became a moment where you're being reduced to name calling and back and forth that is just pure frustration, and it feels just like you're venting. And his tweet, I mean, I remember it got on the front of the New York Times, I believe, as a headline, because he's the most prominent voice in American sports going after a sitting president. You know, it winds up just kind of in some ways stooping to kind of the crassness of the conversation that has, you know, taken over in politics here over the last 4 or 5 years. And while a lot of people thought it was funny, and certainly it was very bold, and I know he caught a lot of flack for it, you know, from... you know, probably the other side of the aisle, if you want to term it that way. It left me with mixed feelings because, you know, ultimately it's like, is this helping anything? Is this moving us forward in any way? Or is this just pure frustration with no outlet that winds up feeling like, you know, you vented and nothing changed? And I think what we've seen here, not only among athletes, but also just among the media, is an idea of like, okay, you've had a few years to kind of figure out how to cover and react to a very unconventional president. Have they made progress on that front? Have they been a little bit more productive, whether it's with the fact checking, whether it's with certain presentation on television, so it's not just airing his interviews without any context, whether it is, you know, pushing back on some of you know, the claims, or even delaying the broadcast so that it's not running live. And then I think from the commentary space, not necessarily treating every single comment at face value, right? And understanding that, you know, perhaps there is some mission trying to be accomplished with some of the things that is being said.
Yes. He is a bad faith operator in just about everything that he tries to communicate to the American people.
So when LeBron takes Trump's criticism, which is, you know, kind of personally leveled at NBA players, you guys are disgraceful, you know, you're disrespecting the flag and those kinds of comments, rather than engaging on those particular topics, LeBron pivots to November is a very important moment for us as Americans, right? And that goes hand in hand with the initiative that we've talked about before, the More Than a Vote campaign. It goes hand in hand with the efforts that the NBA Players, you know, Association has put out there in terms of having vote on some of these guys' jerseys, in terms of opening up NBA buildings as voting precincts. It does feel like a more coordinated, thoughtful response. And you could see LeBron searching for his words when he was talking last night, because he didn't want it to turn into an ugly, you know, let's just throw mud back and forth type of fight. And he already knew that, you know, whatever he said was probably going to provoke potentially another round of a firestorm from media outlets or from, you know, tweets from the president as well. And so it did seem like he was
so ridiculous.
He was trying to be more constructive, don't you think? And it's just like, to me, that's a big difference from you bum to go vote, and here's my effort to help you go vote, right? I think that, I feel a lot better on this one than I did on the you bum one. Does that make sense?
Right. I think that there's a few factors here. I mean, optically, sure. Like, I think in the eyes of some, LeBron looks a little better here. I personally loved you bum a lot. Like, it's one of my all-time favorite tweets. But also,
you seem like the kind of person who would get a T-shirt that's like, has the tweet printed out on the chest. Is that right? I mean, I know your aesthetic a little bit from that Vanity Fair profile cover shoot, but
yeah, no, I'm more the type of person who gets it framed and sticks it up in the living room. That's more of my style with that.
I love it. Social media art. It's just so avant-garde, just, Michael.
It just ups my mood every time I enter the room. But I think another factor here is just, you know, you have a carrot at the end of the stick here, right? Like in 2017, it's a little more difficult to talk about voting and get people enthused about voting when the next election for the presidency is, you know, years away. Right now, it's right around the corner. It's like less than, what is it, like 90 days away or something like that. So you can really sniff change in the air, and LeBron is really grasping the opportunity. And as you said, his More Than a Vote campaign, which spreads awareness, it educates, and it also is very active in tangible ways. I mean, it's raising money to pay for convicted felons in Florida who have to pay fines before they can vote because of voter suppression tactics in that state. And it's just really great to see from LeBron James.
So let's spin this forward one more round and say, okay, well, if this does count as kind of progress in terms of, you know, a communication strategy and just an overall like advocacy and activism standpoint, and we know this is probably going to keep happening over the next 3 months because the election is right around the corner. I think you and I have been sort of predicting this kind of blow up or this kind of face-to-face confrontation really for a couple months now. What would your advice be to LeBron or to Chris Paul or to these other players who could wind up finding themselves in this back and forth? I mean, there is at least some, you know, potential backlash among fans who just, you know, get fatigued of the conversation. You know, I've heard that, you know, from a few people, and a lot of them are, you know, Twitter users. So you have to kind of question, all right, well, are they just trying to make a point, or are they genuine about it? Is there any concern there that they could take this too far? Should they just continue to push it and hope that everybody winds up understanding that they're on the quote unquote right side of history? What would your advice be to them? And I ask that because there was another major announcement yesterday, which was that the NBA and the Players Union have finalized plans for a $300 million foundation. Basically, it will be funded $1 million per year for the next 10 years per team around the league, and the players will have a say-so in how that money gets distributed. The main focus is basically employment-based help and assistance for people trying to get their first job or to advance in their careers. And obviously, it's targeted towards the Black community. So you have these guys working hard to, you know, make real change, to deliver on stuff that's, you know, beyond just the jerseys and the decals on the court and everything else. And now they're going to have the biggest possible stage by kind of going head-to-head with a major political figure. What would your advice be to them as they navigate that?
I think you need to be, continue to be organized, continue to stay on a message. Do not get bogged down in a battle with someone who is really just using you as a pawn in his own scheme to rile up a base that doesn't even care about what you're speaking of and what message you're promoting in the first place. So talk about voting continuously through, I mean, beyond when the season ends, through the November election. Continue to spread awareness about it. Continue to educate people, because a big part of voter suppression is the belief, particularly in minority communities, that their vote does not matter because of voter suppression tactics that have been enacted by different states in the union. So getting out there, making sure people understand how important it is that they do participate in the democratic process, that's a big one. And, you know, getting on Twitter and arguing with Trump or arguing with different Republican senators or whoever, you know, I just don't know how. It does draw attention, I suppose, to some of the, I guess, bankrupt thought from those people on that side. But it's also ultimately not the best way to use your time. I don't recommend, you know, you asked me to give advice. I don't recommend getting on Twitter and arguing with people. That's just not a great way to spend your precious time on this planet.
That's a good take. I guess where I'm kind of going with this is there's that old Michelle Obama phrase about, like, they go low, we go high.
Sure.
And for a while there, that was like unimpeachable logic. Everybody agreed, you know, take the high road, you'll kind of wind up winning. And then there was like a real crisis in 2016, 2017, where people were like, wait a minute, like, they're going really low. Like, do we need to, like, maybe just bend down a little bit or stoop here a little, you know, just like get dirty, get our hands dirty, you know, fight fire with fire. I guess, you know, there was that kind of line of thinking. And now I wonder, though, in this particular moment where public opinion on this particular issue has shifted quite a bit over the last few months in favor of the social justice demonstrators and protesters, I do wonder if they can now just continue to adopt this, you know, that they go low, we go high approach. I think it's more effective. I think if you do get into this back and forth, that's where you'd wind up alienating more people. I think that anyone who was upset by what LeBron said had already kind of made up their mind on this issue, right? And I think if anyone is like in the middle on it or like doesn't have an opinion, that's amazing in our polarized society. But I think they would be able to view LeBron as fairly restrained in what he had to say, and again, productive towards an end goal of let's try to solve this problem at the ballot box, which I think ultimately is a good long-term mm-hmm. goal. So I guess I would say channel your Michelle Obama if they ask me. No one's asking me, but maybe that would be my advice.
Yeah, and I also just want to really quickly say on the note of the fund that is being created by the 30 governors in collaboration with the MBPA that you mentioned, you know, I think that that's really good to see. I'm not disparaging it. I really do hope, though, that it extends beyond that and continues to benefit some of the causes of the Black Lives Matter movement, which is, you know, defunding the police and reforming, hardcore reforming the criminal justice system, education reform, and all these different areas that are affected by systemic oppression. So I think that that is a step in the right direction, but, you know, this is not a fight that will be ended in 10 years or 1 year or however long. It needs to be sustained.
For sure. All right, let's pivot here. Let's get back towards the beautiful game, as LeBron was calling it last night, and everything that's been happening on the court. We've seen a whole bunch of fun storylines develop, whether it is the chase for that West 8th seed. I'm not going to say the chase for the East 8th seed is a fun story by any stretch. I think your Boston...
A crawl for the East 8th seed.
It's sort of like when you get into a sleeping bag and you just roll down a hill. I think that's sure. sort of what's happening in the Eastern Conference for their final spot. Your Boston Celtics are back to life. I'm sure you're breathing a huge sigh of relief. I mean, you and the other minions out there. but you had a really fun story on The Ringer, and you had teased it not too long ago on this podcast, this idea of the one dribble three-pointer. And I had explained mm-hmm. to you back during my NBA playing days how that was one of yes. my favorite shots. And, certainly... it's a contrast to just the pure catch and shoot, which was like completely in vogue there for years and years, thanks to the Spurs and the Warriors and the Rockets and everything else. But talk to me about this story. Give us the elevator pitch for people who haven't gotten a chance to read it. And what was your major takeaway? Like once you put this one to bed after months of planning and everything else, like what was that nugget you wanted everybody to kind of take away from it?
Yeah, so, I mean, with me, sometimes when I come up with story ideas, it'll just be, I'm watching a game, and I see something happen, and I'm like, why did that happen? Is it happening more often than it used to? What are the benefits of it? Why is this meaningful? And so I forget exactly who took the shot. I think it might have been Bojan Bogdanovic, and it was a game like way earlier in the season, and it was the Jazz versus somebody, and he pump faked and he got a flyby on his defender, and typically what you see there was a wide open lane in front of him to drive to the basket, and instead he kind of like sidestepped a little backwards and took this three. And it's like, obviously we know that we obviously know that the three-pointer is really important and that teams want to take as many as possible. But I wanted to look at guys who aren't super athletic, who when a defender is trying to take away their three and smother them, what do they do? How do they respond? And so taking one dribble and taking a sidestep or a step back or... there's just myriad different options that you can take out of that one dribble, but how do they create space for themselves and do they practice it? And so I had this conversation that led me to a conversation I had with Joe Harris at a Nets practice also 1 million years ago, where we talked for quite a while about how important it is to him. And he broke it down for me in really technical form that didn't make the story because it was probably a little boring to the masses. But it was important, and I felt like I was onto something. So then I went and I talked to a whole bunch of different players, and I talked to Drew Hanlon, the skills trainer for Jason Tatum and Zach LaVine and Bradley Beal. And it's a shot that is, you know, taking one dribble and shooting a three is just increasingly important in the league. And I hope that I did a good job of explaining why and explaining why more players are looking to add it to their games and how it can extend careers and how it can add value to different players who otherwise wouldn't have it.
So how much of this trend is a development in response to changing defensive strategies, right? Where, like, if you've got all this space to cover,
right,
and defenses are now more like kind of designed as outside in rather than inside out, so you're just kind of trying to always make sure you have the corners covered, you're trying to make sure you're always, you know, flying around and rotating, you've got faster, longer defensive players as opposed to like the big hulky guys inside. Those guys are now maybe able to cover ground and chase out to shooters and contest three-point shots better than they were a few years ago. How much of the one dribble three is just these guys learning to reset and avoid, you know, the kamikaze defensive closeouts that we see regularly in half court now?
Yeah, that's a huge part of it, Ben, because a lot of these guys entered the league as catch and shoot three. You know, they'd come off a pin down or a flare screen or whatever, and they'd be open for three, and they'd just catch a pass and shoot it, and that was their value. And recently, there has been, I would say over the past 3, 4, 5 years, there has been obviously a much greater focus in terms of taking away those shots because they're so valuable, but then also signing, you know, players to your roster who are athletic enough and long enough and versatile enough to make them really difficult. And the game is obviously super fast, and you know, you sprint out at a shooter, there's a need to be in control and disciplined and to try to get that shooter off the three-point line. But the shooter's job is to stay behind the three-point line and take a three. So yeah, I think that adding one dribble and trying to create that space is just a humongous weapon for some of these guys. And what was really interesting to me also is just how often really good scorers, just like pure scorers like Zach LaVine and Jason Tatum and Brad Beal, I already mentioned all those guys, but Dame Lillard, Harden, Luka, like the one dribble three for them is also really important, just because, you know, you can take, yeah, 6, 7, 8 dribbles and try to get a shot off, but if you can just take one and create that space, that's just, it's quicker, it's more efficient. And I just think it's a really fascinating, I don't know if it's a trend, but it's a really fascinating development that we're seeing.
Oh, for sure. I would consider it to be a trend, in part because the superstar level guys who are doing it in high quantity are now going left with it, going right with it, going backwards with it, stepping
right
forward with it, kind of doing it at different angles. And that's just definitely not something that we saw 5 years ago. It almost reminds me of dodgeball, you know, where it's like, you're like jumping out of the way of the defender, just like you would like jump out of the way of a dodgeball before resetting and throwing back. That's like the visual element to some of this, the resetting stuff. I want to just kind of underscore this for, you know, basketball viewers in terms of like, why is this a big deal? What we used to see with the catch and shoot 3-point guys is, so if they get the ball in the corner and there's somebody closing out hard and they pump fake, you know, defender flies by, now you feel like you're in a 5-on-4 situation, and your natural impulse in that moment is to attack because that defender in front of you is no longer there. And lots of bad things can happen in that situation, especially if you're a Joe Harris or a J.J. Redick or that type of player where you're never really handling the ball a lot, and you're not going to be an above-the-rim finisher most likely, and you're not accustomed to weaving through traffic and reading rotating defenses and, you know, trying to make these dynamic plays around the basket, because that's never your role. So it actually winds up being this psychological trick where you're like forcing guys out of their comfort zone with that hard closeout, and now you're almost suckering them into potentially making a mistake. And, you know, lots of different ways things can happen. They could take a floater, that's a low percentage shot. They could try to get to the rim and wind up having a fast, long closeout defender just stuff them, go the other way. You could have a turnover in traffic, which could happen. I mean, all these things cut into what the analytic dorks would talk about, like expected value of that possession, right? Where it doesn't necessarily have to fail the same way every time, but lots of things can happen when you're pushing guys out of their comfort zone. And what we know about the catch and shoot guys, their comfort zone is, you know, straight on shooting. So taking that one dribble to the side to avoid the hard closeout and then just recalibrating for another three-pointer, the expected value on that shot is very, very high, in large part because they should be wide open without those defenders in the way. So, but it takes learning how to do it for sure and getting your rhythm. And I think that the fact that there are trainers out there, like the people you're talking to, who have formalized this, right? Who have almost turned it into like an assembly line process. And you're seeing guys take these kinds of shots now, actually before games as well. You know, just getting used to the rhythm of that, as opposed to just setting your feet, bang, bang, and shooting. You know, setting your feet, getting the catch, taking the dribble to your left, taking the dribble to your right, and then unloading. It's cool, man. And it was a great idea for a story. And it's the type where I was noticing on Twitter, I think you had a lot of other writers feeling a little jealous, Michael. They're in their feelings, maybe, because they hadn't thought of this one.
No comment on that. I was just really appreciative of the Ringer
so
for publishing
humble,
it.
So humble. Michael DePod, just Mr. Humble.
Yeah, no, but thanks. I mean, you summed it up really well with everything that you just said. I could have just, like, we could have just talked about it, and I could have recorded what you just outlined and typed it out, and that probably would have been a better story, so shout out to you.
Well, I'm not, like, a self-loathing Knicks fan like your other story this week, which I really enjoy. Just, you know, surveying all the most depraved Knicks fans as they watch Kristaps Porzingis was a real stroke of genius from you. Great content. I encourage people to check that one out as well. Hey, we got a bunch of questions from the Open Floor Globe. They emailed us, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. And Michael, we haven't taken a bunch of questions recently because we've just had so much to talk about, but there are some follow-ups that people want to get in and ask questions about the bubble as well. So let's dig in here. Johnny says, plenty of people inside and outside of the black community clearly and obviously are in support of the statement Black Lives Matter, but against the political movement that is Black Lives Matter. A simple glance on their website will show you that their main aim is to defund the police. Some people disagree that Black Lives Matter, the movement, actually has the interests of black people at the forefront of their aims. Unfortunately, it's difficult to express these opinions in times of such heightened tensions, particularly to the media, who are only interested in sound bites. And so that email from Johnny was in response to our conversation about Jonathan Isaac and his protest in terms of, you know, standing during the national anthem rather than kneeling with his teammates and not wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt. Of course, he did say in his interview afterwards that, you know, he's black and Black Lives Matter to him. But he did seem to hint that he wasn't in favor of the particular movement, the specific movement that has kind of gained attention here. It's an important point from Johnny for sure. I'm curious, I mean, Michael, what did you make of this email and the distinction that he's trying to draw?
Yeah, I'm personally, I get a little confused anytime Black Lives Matter is conflated as a political movement. I mean, I suppose like everything, quote unquote, is political, but it's like, Black Lives Matter was started because three black women wanted to see policy changes after seeing, you know, generations of unarmed black people get disproportionately shot and killed by the police. So when they say defund the police, first of all, on the website, which I went to, I'd never really gone there and read the, you know, the What We Believe section. I'd never actually gone there until I read this email, so thank you to Johnny for even pointing that out to me. But I went there and I actually read what's written. And, you know, defund the police is literally hand in hand with, goes literally hand in hand with invest in communities. And there's, at the very end of that section, they write, we embody and practice justice, liberation, and peace in our engagements with one another. That's basically the message of it. They want equality. So these should be basic tenets that everyone is on board with, and I'm just, like, fundamentally confused and a little disturbed when people try to say that it is not in line with what the black community wants. And, I mean, first of all, speaking, I shouldn't generalize and say that the black community, because black people are individuals and it's not a mass way of thinking. But it is sad to me if anyone feels threatened by this organization, and in my opinion, to be in direct opposition to it is kind of the definition of being pro-white supremacy. I don't think there's a lot of wiggle room there.
Yeah, I wonder if this movement, or whatever you want to call it, this phrase even, has just expanded beyond this website, right? Like, if we're just trying to define
for sure
this phrasing, or the t-shirts, or what the NBA players are about, or why they're demonstrating, or why people were protesting, if that is just a heck of a lot bigger at this moment than that particular website or the people who founded it, right? Like sometimes you can have a great idea and it just completely blows up and now it's everyone's idea, right? It's not just your particular idea. And whatever your initial aims, you know, there's going to have to be probably compromises and recalibrations along the way as you're going. And I'm sure for the founders, this has been a really challenging and complicated time, right? Trying to keep whatever their message were as the main messages, as you know, hundreds of thousands of people are in the streets, you know, using that same phrasing. It must be extraordinarily stressful for them. But yeah, I guess it kind of goes back to, okay, so did Jonathan Isaac make it as clear as possible with his actions where his heart stands? And I think that it would be very easy for someone to interpret just even the simple picture of him standing without that t-shirt on in the wrong way. And I do give the media credit for asking him directly, like, do you believe Black Lives Matter? Had that question not been asked, I think he could find himself in a situation where he was really misconstrued. So I don't want to belabor that point. I did just want to kind of like add that level of context in, is there is a clear distinction that Johnny is pointing out. There are a lot of people who agree in principle, but not necessarily with the specifics of that you know, organization. But at the same time, I'm wondering, does focusing on those specifics really even matter as much as it did, say, 6 months ago?
Right. I guess what Black Lives Matter is about, being like not believing in it, is I just don't really understand like what the problem is, I guess. Like, can you kind of, do you see where I'm like, what I'm struggling with here? Like, I just don't understand why, like, I'm not saying like I don't understand why people are racist, but I just don't understand why this has become so controversial, I guess.
Well, I think Johnny's point, I didn't put this in the outline, but Johnny's point was that the idea of defund the police is a lot more controversial than the idea of Black Lives Matter. And so if one of their main goals is like reorganizing law enforcement, and then you have people, especially in like low income or high crime neighborhoods, who might feel differently about that particular issue than someone else, there could just be more debate and more sides to it, and people could be impacted by it more directly in lots of different ways. And in some cases, they could be police officers themselves, because, you know, that's, you know, a major employer in those communities. They might just feel differently about that particular notion. And if they look at the organization Black Lives Matter as being largely focused on defunding the police, that winds up becoming not, you know, not more toxic, but just more of a heated debate. And it's something that there is, you know, multiple mm-hmm. sides to. And you could understand some resistance, even from NBA players, to wanting to align themselves with that movement if they feel passionately about that, right?
No, yeah, that's well said. I mean, when I hear defund the police, I personally just think it means redistribution of wealth in Black communities, towards Black businesses, towards schools, just, you know, desegregation, just all these different things. And so I guess how I view it is obviously not how everyone sees it. And this is such a complicated topic.
No, it's a tough thing to wrap your mind around, man. I'm with you. I mean, everyone has his or her own take on what these particular slogans mean or phrases mean. And there is a wide variety in terms of how people interpret these things. All right, let's shift gears here a little bit. We got a question from MVP listener Thaddeus. He wants to know, serious question, is James Harden all right? Ben, have you seen anything there on the ground in the bubble? And Michael, did you see that video of Harden walking up the ramp at the end of the Blazers game? He looked like he was laboring just to walk up a ramp to get to the locker room. His activity was crazy low against Portland. So I'll start there, Michael, because, you know, your entire life is hanging on James Harden and his ability to carry the load for the Houston Rockets. What did you see? I mean, of course, Houston started out 2-0 looking great. They take one loss, and Thaddeus is ready to jump off ship. But what do you think?
Yeah, come on, Thaddeus. I'm not really concerned at all. You know, Harden, I don't know. I feel like that was like a real... Were you at that game, Ben?
I was. It was a fun game. Portland earned it for sure. They controlled it. It was a little bit choppy at times. Lots of foul calls. Harden was in foul trouble himself. I guess the point that I'm wondering to take away, I'm not so worried about the ramp video. In general, Michael, can we agree? too much coverage of ramp videos this summer. I think we can agree on that, tying it back to our opening conversation as well. Playing for the Rockets seems exhausting, and not even just for Harden and Westbrook. I mean, the style of play stuff is amazing. It does look fun, and they are having fun. Like, their pregame routine, they were doing, like, an impromptu dunk contest, like, throwing alley-oops off the side of the glass, dancing around, you know, having a pretty good time. But they're asking those guys to do an awful lot. I mean, covering an awful lot of ground defensively, taking on physical matchups, having the ball in their hands constantly, creating a lot one-on-one off the dribble, driving hard into the, you know, traffic. And granted, you know, it's usually spread out traffic, so sometimes you're just waltzing to the hoop for layups, but not always. And you're taking blows and getting to the free throw line. I think it's a fair question. You know, if you want to say, how does the Rockets strategy not work? It's because it's so exhausting and it's so overwhelming, and they go so shallow into their bench, and they put so much on the main guys that they could wear down over the course of a series, wear down over the course of games, and just the frantic comeback idea, late in games. It sounds good in theory, but is that replicable? Can you do that night after night after night, or do you just wind up running out of gas? And especially if you're so leveraged on the three pointers, are you going to be able to keep guys in good enough game shape where they're hitting three-pointers consistently and you're not running into one of those worst-case scenarios where it's 27 straight misses at the end of an exhausting playoff series, right?
Yeah, I wonder just how much Harden misses playing with CP, just in that like aesthetic and that style of, we're just going to play really slow and let me dribble, like crouch down and grind out the opposition by switching. And it's really just going to be a half court contest. And then like Westbrook comes along and he's zooming up and down the floor a million miles an hour. And that guy just like never gets tired regardless of what's going on. But like fundamentally, yeah, again, I'm not really too concerned with any of this. I think Harden he's been really productive so far in the bubble. It's a really small sample size, but he looks like himself. And I'm with you with the guy just played however many minutes in a really, like, that was playoff intensity to me. Maybe it's just because I haven't watched basketball in so long, but it seemed very intense, especially relative to some of the other games that I've watched over the past week. And it's like you're catching him right after it's over, and when I run outside after about 15 minutes with a mask on these days, like I look so much worse than Harden did after an NBA game. So I can only imagine just the physical toll that kind of takes on you.
For sure. And we're going to see him again with another game just tonight, against the Lakers, where stylistic mismatch. They are going to have the potential to try to really run the Lakers, and try to stretch their defensive pieces out and take advantage of some of the Lakers' weaker links. And, let's just, from an energy standpoint, the Lakers are on a back-to-back, so that'll be an interesting just viewpoint in how they handle that. They did not look good at all on Wednesday night.
Yeah, I was about to say, did the Lakers even, you call that competing Wednesday night?
Ooh, Michael's getting in some digs. So you're feeling a little, you're feeling your oats, I think is what the phrase they use, because you declared on the last episode the Lakers are not contenders, and they got worked by like 20 points by the Oklahoma City Thunder, didn't have their offense going. I think right now they rank dead last in points, if I'm not mistaken, offensively, which seems kind of impossible. Are you ready to go a step further? Are you going to predict them as out in the first round? I mean, how much are you feeling yourself here, Michael? Are they going to lose in the second to the Rockets? Let's get a little bit more specific, in your anti-Lakers sentiment here.
So I actually just wrote a column about this that was published literally as we're recording. So I'll let people go. You can read that now on GQ.com. The Lakers, they just have a lot of problems, man. Like, you don't want to overreact to a team that shoots 25% from the three-point line over four games, inside a bubble, whatever. But fundamentally, like, just how they're structured and built and the ways that they can play and how limited they are in their options, I just don't see them. Like, at this point, it sounds sacrilegious, but I'd be a little surprised if they even got to the conference finals. I really would. Like, I think that the Rockets, and now everyone who's listening to this is probably like, listening right after the Lakers like trolloped the Rockets by like 40 tonight. But I really think the Rockets are just such a matchup nightmare for them, man. Like, the Rockets can score on anybody because of how they play. And the Lakers, they can't shoot threes. And so that is that's been a problem throughout the entire regular season. And we thought that, you know, oh, they'll just go small and put AD at the five. It's like their half-court offense with AD at the five is just straight up bad. So it has been this whole season. And when you remove Avery Bradley from those lineups, it's just terrible. So I don't see a silver lining here for them. And if they think that, you know, relying on 35-year-old LeBron James to drag them through four straight playoff rounds and relying on Anthony Davis, who has frankly never played like a super meaningful NBA game in his career, to take them over the top, I just don't think that that's a formula for success. And I know that they're the one seed, and I know that Vegas has them with the best championship odds. I don't see it, man. I don't.
I love this. So can I get you to look into your crystal ball for a moment? And yes. It is, let's say it's, you know, probably late September. The Rockets have just eliminated the Lakers in six games. ESPN commentators are just in shambles, right? I mean, like, they're just shocked. They can't believe it. We're all trying to wrap our mind around what's this next month going to look like without LeBron James kind of headlining the bubble. We've got, you know, the three people in the entire world who actually believed in the Houston Rockets, including you, probably dancing a jig, you know, feeling like this is the greatest moment of your life. I mean, what would that be like? What is that alternate history? Like, where does that take you kind of mentally, that hypothetical? You know, what are the conversations that are taking place? What are the overreactions? Are people mad that the NBA didn't rig it for LeBron? Are they tuning out because nobody wants to watch Harden the cheater? Are they finally coming around to Harden and saying like, wow, you know, we kind of left him out of the best player alive conversation? Like, what does that look like if the Rockets do somehow knock out the Lakers?
You're really just painting a utopia for me. I actually think that
it's a Disney impact. I'm on the happiest place on earth, and all I can do is just like dream these magical dreams, you know, beasts become princes, all yes, sorts of stuff exactly. Goes on out here.
Fantasyland. I think that, you know, this goes back to the asterisk conversation. I think you will never see a bigger asterisk in your whole life than if the Rockets win the championship. That's what people will blame the bubble like there's no tomorrow. That'll just be the number one, like, oh, this was the weirdest season. Of course Harden wins the title when everyone is quarantining. Of course that's when Mike D'Antoni finally breaks through and Daryl Morey's analytics campaign works. Like, that's what's going to happen here. I can feel it in my bones.
So fair warning to Adidas, start planning now. You're going to want to have the Adidas asterisk colorway of the James Harden sneakers, right? And Jordan's probably already on this with the Russell Westbrook sneakers. Just get t-shirts with the giant asterisk logo. You've got to lean all the way into it if you're them. Don't you think? Like, don't you have to kind of confront that head on if that's the major talking point?
No, I mean, you should just quit this podcast right now and go work as a marketing executive for Adidas. Have you thought about, have they offered, made any crazy offers to you? They will after they hear this.
Well, look, come on, as a Beaverton boy, yeah, that would be that would be like you working for the Lakers front office. I mean, come on, Michael, that's never gonna happen. All right, we got another question here. It's on fouls though. Dom writes, the NBA is often cited as a league that has its pulse on what fans want. Tell me then why we haven't seen a change in how games are officiated. I think almost everyone is in agreement that there are too many fouls in the modern game. If the NBA wants to boost ratings, then it's in their best interest to tell the officials to relax on the whistle so we can see improved game flow. This point has been accentuated in the bubble, where there's even more fouls than before, making games unwatchable at times, even for a hardcore fan like me. Do you guys agree that there just flat out needs to be fewer fouls? And would doing so boost ratings? Keep up the good work. Well, thank you for that email, Tom. What do you think, Michael? Is it just as easy as being like, hey, guys, put your whistle in your pocket and let them play?
I mean, it sucks when there's more fouls. I think that everyone agrees on that. Watching a game live, watching players take free throws is excruciating for me personally, and it's why Like, I almost never watch games live. I'll always watch them on some kind of delay so I can fast forward through commercials and free throws, be it like 5 minutes, 2 minutes, 3 hours, whatever. Like, I hate just sitting around because I know I'm just going to pick up my phone and then get distracted. So I'm with you, Dom. I 100% agree. But like, at the same time, if players are getting fouled, what do you want the referees to do? It's not like they're making these fouls up. Like, you know what I mean? Like, in, I mean, an example is like the Devin Booker's buzzer beater. Can we agree that he was fouled on that shot over Paul George? Do you think that that was a safe contest, or do you think that, that was a foul, Ben?
I was so mad about Kawhi Leonard, how he played that, that I didn't even necessarily like break down the frame by frame on whether Paul George got him. But why is Kawhi Leonard stunning at Booker to recover to Ricky Rubio in the corner? Can you? I know you're a mathematics major, Michael. What are the odds that Devin Booker passes to Ricky Rubio in that situation? And is it possible that it's negative, like a negative percentage? Is that actually even mathematically possible? I would say a negative 72% that Booker passes to Rubio, or to basically anyone in that spot. Kawhi Leonard's got to get his Michael Jordan on, go jump Devin Booker on the double team and force some crazy fall away so they can go play overtime. I mean, that to me was an inexcusable. And the second one in Orlando, the second late game lapse from your favorite Kawhi Leonard.
Yeah, I'm glad we're talking about this. Because I think that that's my favorite play of the bubble, and that's kind of the signature play of the bubble so far.
It was a sick shot. I'm going to give it to him. I mean, you can't take anything away from that. And even the celebration video was awesome for them. I saw a Suns blog say it was the best shot by someone on the Suns since 2006. And like, oh my God, you know?
Who was that? Kobe's air ball to run our test? Was that what he was referring to?
I want to say there was a Rajah Bell shot, maybe. We're going to have to get fact-checked by a Suns fan, to be honest. I don't have an encyclopedic memory of 15-year-old Suns highlights, unfortunately. But it had been a while. That was the point.
Yeah, and real quick, like, the Clippers' defense for this play was, like, straight-up brilliant. Like, Zubac comes up and doubles Booker, forces him left right to Kawhi. I think they got the possession, Phoenix did, 10 seconds left off a steal. So, like, for the Clippers to be this organized was incredible. And they force him, funnel him to the sideline. Kawhi, like, he leaves his feet, man. Like, he falls for a pump fake, which you don't see that with Kawhi Leonard. He has so much confidence in his own abilities and his length and his huge hands to really dictate the action. So for Booker to get Kawhi in the air, spin the opposite direction, tilt back, drill the shot, like, I gotta just, like, tip my cap off to Devin Booker and say that's one of, like, the best shots I've ever seen. But then also, Kawhi, yeah, I'm with you. What are you doing, man?
Yeah, it was stunning. I mean, maybe he's just trying to, like, convince everybody that they're vulnerable, right? Like, he's just sandbagging a little bit before the playoffs and they just rip off a stretch. But man, that was very questionable. I would like to be in the defensive meeting room where they break down that play and Kawhi has to own up to it, because that was not great. All right, we got a question from JA. He's addressing this one to you, Michael. He says, where is Celtics world on Gordon Hayward? How good is he? I've been watching these games and I can't even tell. It seems like he shoots okay, but not frighteningly well. He makes good cuts, but he's not really pulling in the defense. It seems like he's trying hard on defense and rebounds decently, but I don't know. It seems like he's fine, but maybe not that special. It's always hard to separate our history from our expectations when we're evaluating. I feel like if Hayward was undrafted out of Butler and making a third as much money as he does right now, we'd think of him as a great value role player who didn't necessarily do one thing or another excellent, but was just good all around. Instead, Hayward gets painted as an overpaid guy who does a lot of things well, but nothing amazing, and leaving people constantly wanting for more. Michael, are you with that assessment? Do you have a more green beersy view of Hayward? I mean, where are you on Gordon Hayward right now?
No, I'm pretty realistic and down to earth when it comes to assessing Gordon Hayward and just how he's played and performed since that injury a couple years ago. I mean, I don't think he'll ever be the same guy. He'll never be an all-star again, and that's just a real that's like a gut punch for the Celtics, because you pay him a max contract and he's not even close to that. I mean, fundamentally, everything that our emailer is saying is, like, I'll agree with. Like, he is very up and down. He's very difficult to kind of wrap your arms around analytically and just, I guess, parse what he's doing good and what he's doing bad. I think at the end of the day, he doesn't get as much credit as he deserves for, I mean, just he's so good at, like, everything. You can't look at his game and spot an identifiable weakness, which you can't say about any like a lot of players. So right there, kudos to him. You know, he can pass on the move. He can spot up or shoot off the dribble. He can defend multiple positions. He can finish at the rim. I forget which game it was, but he actually drove the paint and finished with a two-handed dunk, which basically has not happened from my own memory since he's been with the Celtics. So that was, you know, good to see because he used to be super athletic. And he also runs, like, a terrific two-man game with Kemba Walker. They're highly efficient when they operate together. But yeah, at the end of the day, like, he's also not a guy who is going to just, like, drop 39 in a playoff game, which is what you want when you're paying someone the max, right? And he does really smart things. He's really good off the ball. He doesn't really complain when he isn't as involved as he should, and I think he's taken to Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown's ascension extremely well because, you know, he came here to be one of the primary options. That's not going to be the case ever again. So he's accepted that role really well, so you got to commend that as well. But, yeah, it's a little disappointing when you look at how much money he's making. And at the same time, I think the Celtics are pretty satisfied, I would say, with the production they get out of him.
Yeah, I well said, well summarized. I think that in addition to this idea that the emailer was raising about, oh, is he undrafted or, you know, max level player and all that, I mean, he's also a victim of his own career arc expectations in that, you know, he was blossoming into an all-star level player, kind of like number one lead option scorer, makes a big free agency move. It feels like, oh, this is going to be like, you know, kind of the very poor man's version of the decision, right? Where it's like, okay, he's, you know, probably not going to go lead a dynasty, but like this is like a big kind of power move in this entire you know, genre of those types of decisions. I mean, not on LeBron or KD's level, but, you know,
he was the most coveted free agent of that class.
Yeah, which says something about that class, I would
sure,
say. But
fair.
Still, like, you know, the injury winds up changing the entire story and just making it less interesting, making him less explosive, making him less capable of being the number one guy. If you want to run the simulation back and say he never gets injured, I think it's guys like Jaylen and Tatum that are working in around him as opposed to the opposite scenario, right? And maybe Tatum winds up coming along so fast offensively that, okay, he has to be the number one option, right? But I don't think that Hayward would have found himself in as much of a complimentary role as he does now if he had continued ascending as we typically expect for an all-star level wing through his late 20s. And there's nothing he can do to control that. You can't blame a guy for injury. So it just is what it is. It kind of sucks. And there's no way around it. I find myself not particularly enjoying watching him play, even though he's my type of player. No, and this is just like a purely psychological thing. I like his I mean, if you're telling me a guy has no weaknesses, he's a good team player, he's bought into the concept, he can score efficiently when needed, he moves the basketball, he plays hard on defense, he's versatile, that's pretty much my checklist for guys, right? I mean, that sounds like right up my alley. The problem is when I watch him, I just think of what could have been or what should have been, and it just leaves me kind of flat. I'm like, well, this, you know, this is the diet version. This should have been better. And that's a me problem. I don't know how to get around it, but I suspect I'm not the only person who has that issue.
That is a fair criticism. I mean, when he was that all-star in Utah that last season, I mean, it was fair to compare him with Jimmy Butler and
Paul George.
Even Paul George, yeah, I was going to say. That's how good he was. And so, and just as a wing and a prototypical wing in this modern NBA. So yeah, from that perspective, 100%, I agree with you. It's a little disappointing, but like, here we are, this is the reality. And you kind of just got to take and see what you have in front of you.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, the Brad Stevens offense where careers go to die, that's just too bad. All right. We got a question here from Nick in Switzerland. He writes, There's one thing I'm a little disappointed about. You can't hear the players talking on the court when I'm watching on these broadcasts. Before the restart, a lot of people were talking about how awesome it would be to hear everything that was being said to the referees and so on, but now there's just nothing at all. I understand that the NBA maybe doesn't want the public to hear some of this stuff, but is there some possibility that this could change? Should we start a petition? And this question's for Bubble Ben. Have you heard any interesting stuff when you're at the games? So, Nick, I don't anticipate a petition necessarily working here. I think the NBA is feeling very good about its television product and what's available and what's not. I feel like the players are pretty comfortable with that, too. In terms of the arguing for calls, it actually sounds quite a bit like it would in a rec league game. Guys are screaming and one an awful lot. They scream, blow the whistle. They scream, did you see that? They scream, how did you miss that? You know, basically any kind of appeal that you would make to a referee in your five-on-five, you know, pickup lunch league, that's what the players do. Now, one amazing scenario that played out the other night, well, amazing for basketball dorks, Lakers-Thunder, Chris Paul winds up getting called for a defensive foul when LeBron is posting him up. And Chris Paul felt like he had established the position. He didn't feel like he had extended his arm. He felt like he was, you know, in a completely legal spot. So he first, you know, asked the on-court referee, like, basically, like, what happened? Why did I foul him? And he looked pretty miffed. So then he started shouting down the court to Monty McCutcheon, who's been sitting courtside at almost every game. Monty McCutcheon might be the only person who's attending more games than I am. Sam Presti also in that mix, by the way. Just, you know, real basketball diehards going to these games constantly. So Monty's sitting like 80 feet away from the play, and he is now an executive. He's not even an official anymore. He's like kind of oversees all the referees. And Chris Paul starts an extended conversation with Monty, addressing him by name. Monty, what did I do? You know, like, what did you see there? What happened? And we're all just kind of chuckling at it. You know, this was in the first half. Come out after halftime, Chris Paul, like, strolls over towards where Monty's sitting, and Monty has to remind him, like, look, I can't come on the court, right? We have to be socially distant, but, like, if you stay there, I'll stay here, and we could try to, like, talk this one out and mediate it. And so Chris is still, you know, like, kind of working the officials more than half an hour after that call. And by the way, Oklahoma City's winning comfortably the entire game. They went on to win the game. I just thought it was like the most peak Chris Paul moment combined with the most peak Monty McCutcheon moment, because he's just the nicest guy and will kind of engage on any issue and always stand up for the referees. Also combined with like the most peak Bubble moment, all wrapped into one, right? Because this is sort of what we thought would happen if we all get to sit courtside and hear things. We would get to hear Chris Paul gripe for more than a half an hour and take it to the bosses, right? Like, I mean, he's talking to the manager on this one.
That is an incredible story. This is exactly what I was hoping that you would provide when I heard that you were first going down to the Bubble. So great. That's awesome. I guess, like, to answer Nick's question, I view not being able to hear the players as something just short of a national tragedy. Like, I've wanted this since I was little, and, you know, just put it, like, put the games on, I don't know, like, HBO or something, and even if they air on, like, a 24-hour tape delay, I would just watch all the games twice just so I could get the experience of hearing the players talk without announcers or anything. Like, that's just what I think everybody wants. We're probably never going to get it. If we're not getting it now, then, yeah, that doesn't bode well for the future. But it is cool for you because you get to, like, it's, I would imagine it's relatively silent compared to a normal NBA setting. You're obviously sitting very close. And to hear, you know, players shouting at refs, players shouting at coaches, coaches shouting at everybody, like, that's awesome to hear.
Yeah, it's pretty good. You can't hear everything, but you can hear a lot. The other thing I would say, Nick, is if you see when the players are gesturing up to the big screen and trying to tell the referees that they missed a call, that's exactly what they're doing. It's really not as interesting as it seems. Like, they just say, hey, look right there, you missed it. Look, there's video right there showing that you missed the call. That's pretty much what that conversation sounds like in real time. So the veil of secrecy that maybe you're feeling would be amazing behind the veil. It's very cool, but it's also like completely predictable. I would also say, like, other than a stray profanity here and there, if a ball goes out of bounds or, you know, a guy, you know, takes a shot, you know, like below the belt or something like that, there's not really objectionable content. Like, these guys aren't cussing the refs out for 3 minutes straight, right? They're not demeaning people. I haven't heard anything that really crossed the line. Now, could we get there later in the playoffs? It's possible, just because the intensity level will ramp up. But I think that in general, there's a lot of sportsmanship going on. You know, these guys want calls. They're definitely trying to work the officials, but they're doing so, you know, with agreed upon terms, you know, and they're generally not crossing the lines. All right, last question here from Joel. He writes, I'm the guy who was shooting free throws in my driveway when the deer showed up, and you guys mocked me, saying that I needed stronger mental fortitude. Then, a few weeks later, you guys talk about how hard it was for Rudy Gobert to shoot his free throws in a near-silent, empty gym. I demand an apology. Wow, Michael, do we owe our buddy Joel an apology? Does he have a point here?
No, I don't think. I don't even recall being too harsh on Joel. I mean,
well, that was me. I mean, I was the one who basically said he needed to, like, line up other animals to kind of improve his mental focus. I mean, if the deer's throwing him off, like, I was a little bit nervous. But Joel, I mean, come on. There was a lot of pressure in that moment. The whole COVID angle to it, the comeback, the idea that he's a 7 foot. I mean, maybe if Joel's a 7 foot center, I would be more more understanding about his struggles in front of the deer, because ultimately, like, it's a lot harder to shoot free throws if you're a big guy. We've seen that throughout history. Joel, no offense, I was picturing you as basically between 5'10 and 6'1, you know, wearing basketball shorts that maybe embarrass your wife when you wear them in public, you know, shooting on maybe like an 8.5 foot rim. Maybe this is all my projection. I don't know, Joel. I'm sorry. You know, this is all my assumptions here. Just a slightly different game condition than opening night of the NBA bubble with millions of people watching on television at home. That's what I'm saying.
Right. I agree. I don't think that Joel experienced the harsh criticism of being basically the first high profile figure in this country to test positive for coronavirus. So
are you demanding that Joel proves that he's actually a patient zero? Is that what you're saying before we're going to apologize? God, Michael.
My standards are high. What can I say?
Incredible. Joel, you make a good point. I'm not going to apologize. I don't think we have anything to apologize for, but certainly keep working on your free throw shooting and maybe send us your dimensions. Now that we've called you out as a 5'10 dorky guy in basketball shorts, you can let us know how you're really rocking out there when you're shooting your free throws amid the wildlife. All right, Michael, we've made it to the end of another episode of Open Floor. Guys, email us openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. Like Michael said, we really enjoyed that question from Switzerland about, like, what's it like in the bubble? What's the experience like? If you have any other similar questions to that, let me know. I've been down here for a month. I'm not sure I'm ever going home, so I'm glad to take those kinds of questions all day long. Michael, they can find us on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When they find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Michael's on Instagram and Twitter at Michael V as in Victor Pina. Be sure to check out all the pieces of content that we mentioned earlier. He was everywhere, from The Ringer to GQ and right on down the list. 538, don't want to leave them out. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver. I'm on Twitter at Ben.Golliver. Please check out my Twitter page. Sign up for my Washington Post newsletter. I would greatly appreciate it. All right, guys, until next week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.